1961 with the construction of the wall, and 1973 with the signing of the basic treaty, Grundlagenvertrag, between East and West Germany. Framing these dates are a four-year prologue from 45 to 49 and a roughly one-year epilogue. My own studies on this subject can be found especially in the CD series Musik in Deutschland 1950 bis 2000, produced by Frank Schneider and myself for the German Music Council. This series, released between 2000 and 2004, consists of 122 CDs with booklets in six categories: concert music, electronic music, music theater, applied music, jazz, and popular music. Come to the opening scene, the Soviet zone of occupation. With the unconditional surrender of the German Wehrmacht on the 8th of May 1945, the disaster of Nazi rule came to an end. The new regulation of the political, social, and economic order on Germany's reduced territory was now placed in the hands of the four victorious Allied powers, who took charge of dividing the country into zones of occupation. The political division between the Western zones and the Eastern zone, dominated by the Soviet Union, was reflected in the four sectors of the nation's former capital, Berlin. In this year, if you allow me a kind of side mark, of course, by the celebration of the, not celebration, but the memory of the outbreak of the First World War, it was quite a large and interesting discussion on the differences between the so-called Versailler Vertrag at the end of the First World War and what was done after the Second World War. The political division between the West, I think I have cited. For Germany, the fresh start marked a Stunde Null, a zero hour. At first, the removal of the Nazi superstructure was of paramount importance. Migrants, Germans who had fled into exiles as victims of Nazism, but were now willing to return, tended to choose the Soviet zone over the Western zones, as it seemed to offer favorable opportunities to build a better Germany, one defined by socialism rather than race. But it soon became apparent that one dictatorship, the Nazi state, had yielded to another, guided by a communist party dependent on the victorious Soviet Union. This was the Socialist Unity Party, or in German, SED, Sozialistische Einheitspartei Deutschlands, Einheitspartei because it was built from the Social Democrats and the communists. Once again, the population was systematically subjected to a single party. This had consequences for music. The state of affairs, which occurred in the Soviet Union in 48, placed a gag order on free forms of artistic expression, brutally imposing the slogan of socialist realism against formalism in the interest of realpolitik. It was to become fundamental for the newly formed state of East Germany. Now we come to the foundation of the German Democratic Republic. The GDR was founded in 1949, just a few months after its Western counterpart, the Federal Republic of Germany. This act of foundation did not create a new sovereign state so much as a temporary and provisional solution. In the years around 1950, the Soviet Union was prepared to unify the four zones of occupation into a neutral state. But the United States and the first chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, chose instead to establish a federal republic in the West as a bulwark in the Cold War. There then followed the Soviet blockade of West Berlin, broken by the mighty logistics of the Berlin Airlift in 1948-49, the suppression of the East German workers' rebellion by Soviet troops on June the 17th, 1953, and above all else, the Soviet military intervention in Hungary in 1956. These events revealed that the democratic pluralism in the countries of the Warsaw Pact was an illusion, exposing the tyranny behind the mask of party and military leadership. All this was accompanied by a pan-German idea of music that projected earlier national traditions into the future. Yet the way it did so barely departed from the anti-modernism and anti-internationalism of Nazi ideology. The word degenerate merely being replaced by decadent. Today, I wish to present several documents to illustrate this idea. Ottmar Gerster, the chairman of the East German Composers Union, expressed himself as follows in an appeal to the composers and musicologists of Western Germany. By the way, it's quite interesting to read these documents because I noticed that musicology in that time, in that place of the world, had a far higher esteem than today. It is actually mentioned, appeal to musicologists. Weltanschauliche und politische Differenzen gelten wenig, wenn es um die Sicherung des Friedens und die Einheit Deutschlands geht. Ein Bach, ein Beethoven und ein Brahms waren, wie alle großen Meister der Vergangenheit, nicht Ost- oder Westdeutsche, nicht Nord- oder Süddeutsche, sondern eben deutsche Künstler. Auch wir wollen deutsche Künstler sein. By the way, Gerster was, of course, an exponent of Nazi Germany, and then he came to the GDR and has formulated this. We have here a photograph of Ernst Hermann Mayr speaking at the Leipzig Bach Congress in 1950. The Congress slogan, Bach's Werk ist nationales Kulturerbe des ganzen deutschen Volks. Bach's music is a cultural legacy of the entire German nation. Links a pan-Germanic claim of the old master with the Marxist-Leninist theory of genetic heritage. In 1950, Ernst Hermann Mayr, a composer, musicologist, and member of the Central Committee of the Socialist Unity Party, composed his Mansfelder Oratorium, the Pass of the Mansfeld Miners, for speaker, solo voices, chorus, and orchestra, to words by Stefan Hermlin. It is a work completely untouched by aesthetic modernism. Let us listen to a brief excerpt.
Wende seinen Zorn von uns. Will es Gott also haben, so wird es also hinausgehen, dass der gemeine Mann regieren soll. Also sprach Friedrich, Kurfürst von Sachsen. In der Grafschaft Mansfeld auf. Graf Albrecht zu Mansfeld legte allen möglichen Fleiß an und gab den Bergleuten die besten Worte, damit sie sich nicht zu den aufrührerischen Bauern ins Feld begeben. Und so geschah.
Nationalism bore a different relation to modernism in the work of the Schönberg pupil Hans Eisler. An Austrian citizen expelled from his American exile in 48 as a result of the McCarthy hearings. At first he returned to Vienna, only to move to East Berlin in 49. In the autumn of that year, he wrote a music for the national anthem of the newly founded GDR, two words by Johannes R. Becher. The beginning reads with its melody as follows, and I cannot compete with Richard from yesterday. I just have this for you to imagine. Auferstanden aus Ruinen und der Zukunft zugewandt, lasst uns dir zum Guten dienen, Deutschland, einig Vaterland. Germany, United Fatherland. Like many such anthems, East Germany has had its quirks. The notion that the national anthem clearly and coherently expresses the essence of a nation is, of course, as we know from many examples, wrong-headed. It thus comes as no surprise that Eisler's anthem was accused of plagiarizing Peter Kreuter's hit tune, Goodbye Johnny. Still more grievous, however, were Becher's words. With their prospect of German reunification in the fourth line, Deutschland, einig Vaterland, or its Submeistersinger version, Deutschland, heilig Vaterland. As a result, from 72 to 1990, while East German athletes were sensationally piling up victory upon victory, their national anthem could only be presented in instrumental form, its words having become obsolete. An unlucky star shone down on Eisler's musical output in East Germany. The most revealing evidence with regard to nationalism and dictatorship is Eisler's operatic project Johann Faustus. Eisler imprudently published the opera's libretto before he had truly embarked on its composition. Part of the Socialist Unity Party criticized the libretto as an attack on Goethe's status as an unassailable bastion of German national literature. A Philistine position guaranteed to nip creativity in the bud. Allow me to quote an article published in Neues Deutschland on May 14, 1953. Zu diesen Schöpfungen, das heißt Eislers optimistischen, volkstümlichen, wegweisenden Massenliedern, steht der Johann Faustus im Widerspruch. Er ist pessimistisch, volksfremd, ausweglos, antinational. Daher halten wir diesen Text für ungeeignet als Grundlage für eine deutsche Nationaloper. Unquote. The debate, heatedly conducted in a dictatorial system, had to end with a party prevailing over the creative freedom of a lone musician. Artistically, it broke Eisler's back. Does it not speak volumes about the DDR that Eisler never set his libretto for Johann Faustus to music? And we come to the third part, the construction of the wall and its aftermath, 61 to 73. The construction of the wall stabilized the GDR both economically and politically, but it wholly unmasked the state as a dictatorship. All it managed to accomplish was to stop the growing number of East Germany citizens from migrating to the West. And it brought about a certain cultural differentiation within the country's society. However, the constant comparison with living standards in the Federal Republic via radio and television continued unabated. In our context, it is more important to underscore the differences that pertained between East and West Germany, for they prevented the concept of a socialist German nation in East Germany from being exposed prima facie as a chimera. One major difference resided in the far greater integration of women in the workforce. To begin with, in West Germany of the 1960s, women's place was seen to be in the home. Whereas in East Germany, women could expect to receive paid professional employment. Here I quote Ulrich Herbert: women took on activities previously dominated by men, but men did not take over the classical duties of women, unquote. To choose an example of a woman composer who added to the large number of female artists in music history and who probably lacked a West German counterpart in the 60s, let me play an excerpt from a violin concerto composed in 1963 by Ruth Zechlin. Thank you. How should music of this sort be described, analyzed, and historically contextualized? Can we hear that it was written by a woman? Though these questions cannot be answered here, allow me to suggest two directions in which an answer might be sought. The first takes its bearings on an international state of the musical material, on the idea of newness in a general history of music. The state of international seclusion and self-asserted sovereignty, however, was now joined by a growing attitude within East Germany towards its own brand of nationalism. This attitude provides a second avenue for understanding that is perhaps more deserving of historical investigation than the first. East German artists were generally not so naive as to be satisfied with a cultural autopsy diagnosed by Karlheinz Stockhausen in 1959, namely the mindless prolongation of tradition, here of Bartók. They were able to capitalize on the difference postulated by Günther Mayer between the state of the musical material and the manner in which it is treated. They could also avail themselves of the multilinguistic rhetorical potential of nascent postmodernism. Following Eisler's death in 62, the role of East Germany's leading musician passed to a composer 4 years his senior, Paul Dessau. His home in Zeuthen near Berlin became a forum for deep discussions, a private Marxist Darmstadt, with visitors of the stature of Henze and Nono. One of Dessau's songs, Noch bin ich eine Stadt, on a poem of 43 written by Bertolt Brecht, illustrates a complicated predicament of German nationalism. The poem reads as follows. Noch bin ich eine Stadt, doch nicht mehr lange. 50 Geschlechter haben mich bewohnt. Wenn ich die Todesvögel jetzt empfange, in 1000 Jahr erbaut, verheert in einem Mond. In 1943, when this poem was written, Brecht and Dessau were both living in exile in California. Dessau sets a poem that very year. The recording we shall now hear was made in March 1974, not in Zeuthen, but on the other side of the wall, in West Berlin, more precisely in the studio of EMI Records in Zehlendorf. It is sung by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau with Aribert Reimann at the piano. Thank you. come to the next, from the signing of the Basic Treaty, 73 to 89. A new generation of composers then came to the fore, most of whom have now passed away, such as Friedrich Goldmann, Rainer Bredemeyer, Friedrich Schenker, but including one who is still living, Georg Katzer. Headstrong and unconventional, they confronted the East German situation with music that was intelligent and wavered, witty and interconnected. True, in 1971, when the function of first secretary of the SED Central Committee changed from Walter Ulbricht to Erich Honecker, there were hopes for a thaw. But in mid-November 76, following a concert in Cologne, the critical folk singer Wolf Biermann, who had immigrated to East Germany from Hamburg, was expelled from the country. I personally viewed this as a declaration of bankruptcy by the GDR. When a state must adopt such extreme measures to silence its critics, its end, sooner or later, is a foregone conclusion. Thanks to the Basic Treaty with West Germany, the GDR prospered somewhat compared to the other states of the Soviet bloc. Yet the sense of identity among its citizens was far less pronounced than in the case of Hungary or Poland, where it filled the entire national terrain. The constant comparisons with West Germany through Western television, which was tolerated at the time, proved to be a thorn in the side of the GDR, a thorn it was never able to remove. Owing to its egalitarian distribution of wealth and income, and the government-controlled activities of its local and regional cultural institutions, the next two, with the result of no Arbeitslosigkeit in the GDR, the next two decades of its music history were a phase in which a new musical culture began to flourish. In spite of state censorship, East German musicians and musicologists enjoyed relatively favorable conditions as far as commissioned works, relations with publishers, publishing conditions, and performance opportunities were concerned. The number of those who have chosen the path of emigration, as did Peter Gülke and Thilo Müller-Medek, was therefore fairly small. To return to the question of a methodology of East Germany's music history, we should contrast Stockhausen's above-mentioned view with a different one that reveals a greater understanding of the functional mechanisms, living conditions, forms of communication, and artistic goals of the country's inhabitants. In musicology, I feel such methods are still undeveloped. An attempt might be made to draw on post-Soviet cultural history, as presented in exemplary fashion by Karl Schlügel, a German historian of Eastern Europe, in his slender volume, Archaeologie des Kommunismus. In this case, we would not simply study works as documents of music historical nationalism, but would face the task of unearthing the threads of music historical life in a vanished state, and to lend words to their validity. As in the West, East Germany witnessed the growth of specialist ensembles devoted to the performance of contemporary music. One outstanding example is the Gruppe Neue Musik Hans Eisler, a Leipzig ensemble that gave many world premieres, including some by West German composers. Let us hear an example from Hades da Orfeo, Dramma per Musica from 1977 by the ensemble's trombonist Friedrich Schenker, who was also a composer. Kind of musica negativa from beyond the Iron Curtain. In the 1980s, the final decade of the DDR, its international renown grew apace. The existence of two parallel German states seemed to have become a reality. A climax occurred in September 87, with a lavishly staged official visit of Erich Honecker in Bonn, during which, to be sure, the West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl raised the still unresolved question of a pan-German national future during his televised after-dinner speech. Thereafter, events in Europe came thick and fast, triggered by the economic and political crises among the nations of the Warsaw Pact, and belatedly joined in East Germany by an opposition movement closely associated with the Lutheran Church, with the goal of reforming socialism. We come to the epilogue, the transformation and dissolution of the DDR. Within a few years, the Warsaw Pact states in Central Europe parted ways from the Soviet Union, beginning with Poland and Hungary in 89 and joined by East Germany the following year. By the end of 1991, the Soviet Union had ceased to exist. Once Hungary had removed the barriers at its border with Austria in May 89, the Berlin Wall sensationally crumbled in the night of November the 9th. Without the support of Moscow, which had abandoned the methods of dictatorial rulership, the Socialist Unity Party could no longer maintain its power in the DDR, then heading toward economic collapse. In the same month, on November the 28th, Chancellor Kohl proclaimed a 10-point plan that primarily sought for the people of East Germany the right to self-determination. The East German opposition groups, whose peaceful protest had precipitated the opening of the wall in 1989, sought ways to improve socialism within a reformed East German state. So did many musicians and musicologists, who likewise balked at the sort of Germany reunited within the legal framework of the Federal Republic. I have never forgotten the tenacity with which Eberhard Klemm, a musicologist grossly disadvantaged in the GDR, resisted the rapid absorption of East German musicology into West Germany's professional body, the Gesellschaft für Musikforschung, although it was perfectly feasible at the time and eventually happened anyway. The artistic and cultural intelligentsia may have longed for reform of the GDR, but the great majority of the population sought quick reunification, and I would say not entirely for materialistic reasons. The idea of East Germany as a sovereign socialist state, this parcelet of a socialist nation state, collapsed like a house of cards. The comparatively rich musical culture of this GDR was thus condemned to perish. No longer people can enjoy nearly endless time for discussions. No longer can composers have their own personal biographer. And of course, the goal of viewing music as a means of socialist education is obsolete. Now that Western law has entered the realm of Germany's new federal states, it is only a matter of time before Germany's regional musical cultures, even in our age of globalization, will reassert their existence. With this, I reach my conclusion. What do we learn, ladies and gentlemen, from the special case of the GDR? Germany's history was dependent on constellations of power in Europe and in the world. The reality of the Cold War, which brought about the partition of Germany, caused the wish for unity expressed in Becher's national anthem, unjustly known in West Germany as a hymn of division, Spalterhymne, to seem pious but far-fetched. Like other countries of Central and Eastern Europe, East Germany had a communist party dictatorship, but it could never experience its destiny in the same nationalistic spirit as Hungary and Poland, to give just two examples. The linkage of nationalism and dictatorship undermined the idea of an East German nation from within, and made it a ramshackle construct, notwithstanding all its superficial triumphs of recognition. After October 3rd, 1991, the day of German unity, the East German national anthem has been neither sung nor played. Becher's line, Deutschland, einig Vaterland, with Eisler's melody, has become a democratic reality foreign to anything envisioned by its creators. Thank you. Richard.
McCarthy. It was the congressional, the House Un-American Activities Committee that judged him, and his main interrogator was Richard Nixon, and not McCarthy. And another thing about Eisler that you could have mentioned that seemed very interesting and apropos is that although he wrote the East German national anthem, he was never a citizen of East Germany. He retained Austrian citizenship, as did Georg Knepfler and I'm sure others. Yeah, that's another thing that seems to foretell the end, it seems to me, that even those who were most loyal to it had a reservation when it came to actually connecting their fate to the fate of the country. And I also was a little perplexed as to why you said that the oratorio by Ernst Hermann Mayr, the first example that you played, was untouched by modernism, since obviously he was exploiting the trope of grotesque with that very, very low basso, you know, and seemed to me that that was a form of modernism. Although the harmony was not very dissonant and so on, and that's probably what you had in mind, but I was wondering what you might think of that.
As a point with Eisler and McCarthy, I think it's, I would say, you certainly will know this better than myself. I thought that it would be correct to say that McCarthy's activities were actually linked with this committee of un-Republican
activities. McCarthy was a senator.
Yeah.
And the committee was the House of Representatives, the
okay.
two branches, the two
okay.
houses
yeah, yeah,
of our...
Yeah, right, thank you. Now, with Ernst Hermann Mayr, well, you know, it is always difficult to use such general terms as modernism or not modernism, and if one has in mind, as I do have, all the vituperation of modernism by the in the writings and speeches of Ernst Hermann Mayr, of course, one cannot without being influenced by in such context, hear these measures. Myself had the impression far more that it's kind of socialist models based on the German cantata tradition, and so it's kind
right,
of
but distorted
inverted religion. So, well, if you think, of course, it is always difficult to say when dissonances can be acclaimed or appraised as being traditional in the sense of counterpart rules, or when they are independent structures labeled with the term modern. I think it's an open field, and I intentionally didn't want to get into those details, which can only be clarified by analysis. And shall I be happy with your support of Ernst Hermann Mayr as a modern artist?
Well, he was a great musicologist, whatever you think of his music, don't you think?
The music by musician or not
he
by
was,
musicologist?
Ernst Hermann Mayr was a great musicologist, whatever you think of his music.
Yeah, I do know that, and I would say the general appraisal of Ernst Hermann Mayr goes in this direction, positive for musicology, down round for music, and now it is okay, and I meant, but I mentioned the fact that he was the only person of the field of music which was member of the central committee of the party. It was actually not in 1950, he became member of the central committee in 71 and remained it through his death. This is a gerontocracy of the Soviet Republic in when he died in high age. But nevertheless, it is difficult, I think, to judge these documents from a person who is younger and come from a neutral state. And I would say interesting for me to live now in Humboldt University, or teach, or I've taught at Humboldt University, the most exposed place of East Germans music and musicology, to see that kind of obsession with some persons, these older structures, these older memories, these older thing, it's not past, as long as all these persons do live. I had an aunt in Switzerland, and when we went into political discussions, and I had a kind of left-wing argument, then the aunt always said, in Schweizerdeutsch, "Geh doch übere," which meant go beyond the water in the GDR. She died before I got the position in Berlin, because it's a kind of irony to be there where the town had wished me to be.